kind of nice to see people working on this particular topic. This is an article published August 25th, 2018 in Quillette, or Quillette, Quillette.com. And we'll put the link below. And the guy who wrote it, it's a pen name, man or woman, I suppose. The Dangers of Ignoring Cognitive Inequality. Very interesting. I always like it when I learn something utterly new and shocking about history I had no idea about before. I'm going to share that with you. So it starts, as there seems to be this kind of template for this stuff, it starts with an anecdote about the Australian mass shooter Martin Bryant, who murdered 35 people and wounded 23 more, and then pled guilty to a list of charges. And then we point out, or the writer points out, the most notable and concrete fact of Bryant's psychological condition was his extremely low IQ of 66, well within the range for mental disability. And so we go into IQ stuff, which is important to know. This is one of the most essential elements of the modern world. IQ scores are classified in a number of ways, all of which are broadly similar. The Wechsler Adult Intelligence Score, Ways 4, establishes 7 categories of IQ scores. Most of us fall into the average band, constituted by the 90 to 109 range. Those achieving scores of 130 or higher are considered very superior. Conversely, scores of 69 and under are classified as extremely low and automatically qualify the scorer for a diagnosis of mild retardation, according to the APA's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It is also in this band that Bryant's score falls. Now, this is very interesting, and whenever I point out the functionality of high IQ people and the dysfunctionality of low IQ people, people get mad, which we'll get into. I'm sorry about the facts. Don't shoot the messenger. So there is, of course, this general argument that, you know, poor neighborhoods have high crime. Well, not necessarily. It's around racial demographics as well. The Appalachians are very poor in the United States, but not a lot of high crime. Rural areas can be very poor, not a lot of high crime. And during the Great Depression in the 1930s, people were extraordinarily poor, but crime did not explode. And it does seem to be the case that the data is, well, the causality is the reverse of what people think. So people say, oh, it's a poor neighborhood, there's going to be high crime. So if we give the poor people more money, crime will go down. This doesn't really happen. In fact, sometimes over the long run, it works the opposite way for reasons we'll get into in a few minutes. But the reality is that lower IQ neighborhoods tend to be poor, and the low IQ produces the crime, which also produces the poverty, right? If there's a lot of crime around, people don't want to start businesses, they don't want to hire people, they don't want to move in. And so this is where you get this kind of moat around these particular neighborhoods. So the connection, the article says, the connection between intelligence and behavioral problems, such as conduct disorder or antisocial personality disorder, was well known around the time of the Port Arthur massacre. A review, you can follow these links if you want, a review cites contemporaneous studies to suggest that low IQ scores in childhood should be considered a risk factor for antisocial personality disorder and conduct disorders. And these are pretty bad disorders. In 2010, several psychologists published results from a longitudinal study containing data on over 1 million Swedish men. I guess this is back when Swedish men were the expected Swedish men, who were tracked from conscription for a little over 20 years. They found that IQ scores tested during conscription were a significant and robust predictor, not only for antisocial personality disorder or conduct disorder, but for all categories of mental disorders. Conscripts with low IQ were substantially more likely to be diagnosed with one or more mental disorders, to suffer from mood and personality disorders, and to be hospitalized for mental illness. Those in the lowest band, like Bryant, were most at risk of severe psychological disorders. So here is the scale. It's not the most pretty graph you'll ever see, but it's very informative. I don't know why we've got this scale going up to 100 when no number seems to go past 10. Maybe it's to make it look less stark. But here you can see the IQ scale from lowest to highest, from 1 to 9. I guess they've gone beyond the 7 here. But and hazard ratio is the risk. So as you can see, the risk of schizophrenia, other non-affective psychoses, mood disorders, neurosis, and somatoform disorders, well, the risk for that goes up exponentially as IQ goes down. So IQ is, I suppose, because it correlates to some degree, to a large degree, with reaction times and other things. IQ is like a well-functioning brain, and it seems to be a shield. So this mad genius, he's so smart, he's unstable or whatever, doesn't at all accord with the data. And of course, everyone in the comments below is going to say, well, I knew a smart guy who was really dysfunctional. It's like, yeah, I get it. I mean, I understand that, but please take the idea that the plural of anecdote is data, take that and just go elsewhere. You need a lower IQ channel. It's just not for you, not for you here. So as you can see, as IQ goes up, mental disorders go down. Now, let's look at these kinds of things, right? Hazard ratio and IQ scale for personality disorders as a whole, alcohol-related disorders, other substance use disorders, adjustment disorders, any other diagnoses, as you can see, it's dose-dependent. The smarter you get, the less likely you are to have these kinds of disorders. So when I was talking in a video previously about how high IQ tends to be a shield against addiction, everyone was like, well, I know a smart guy who got a disorder. Right? It's like, oh, man. The amount of energy you people waste in this world is prodigious, let's just say. So this is from the Swedish score. So as you can see, lower IQ, higher dysfunction, higher addiction, higher psychological disorders. It is very, and you see, it's not random. It's very, very much dose dependent. Very, very much dose dependent. So this is important, right? So when I talk about IQ, when I talk about ethnicity and IQ, these are all very, very important things to understand. It's the single biggest issue in the world today, which is why I take the hits from idiots for talking about this kind of stuff. I mean, people who are addicted to cigarettes didn't like it when doctors talk about smoking being bad for you, and I get it. I get it. So here, this is a question of distribution, right? So here, in a population where intelligence is normally distributed with a mean of 100. So here we're talking about the white population. The white population, IQ are constantly recalibrated to be 100 as the center of the scale, and East Asians, Chinese, Japanese, South Koreans, and so on, score higher than whites. Ashkenazi Jews score higher than East Asians, particularly in language scores for the most part. And so here we're talking about the white population. In a population where intelligence is normally distributed with a mean of 100, a little over 2% of people would attain IQ scores close to Bryant. Right, so he was 66, so about 2% of whites have an IQ in that range. Now, this is one of the big problems when talking about places like sub-Saharan Africa, where the average IQ for blacks is in the 70s, and it's in the low 70s. So that's a huge problem. That's a huge problem. It means that not far from 40 to 50% of the sub-Saharan blacks would be in the category of this guy's, in the range, like in the mid to high 60s, of this guy's IQ. Now, this is interesting as well. A further 15%, right, so 2%, a little over 2% of whites would have an IQ score close to the 66 for Bryant. A further 15% of whites would receive IQ scores somewhere below 84, well beyond the threshold for disqualification in the Armed Forces Qualification Test, used to determine suitability for admission into the U.S. Army until 1980. So 84. So 15% of whites have IQs below 84, but the average IQ for blacks in America is in the mid-80s. So it's close to 50%. And that's a big challenge, right? So the Army can't find much to do for people with an IQ of 84 or below, right? So it says careers for below this level are extremely rare, a fact that might help explain the correlations between low IQ and an enhanced risk of criminal offending, given the scarcity of well-paid jobs for those with an IQ of below 84. And again, is it just the low pay, or is a lower IQ, you can't really see over the horizon of the immediacy of your own actions, you want something for nothing? And because, my friends, the reason I talk about this is out of massive sympathy and concern for people who, through no fault of their own, I really, really understand this, it is through no fault of their own that they are born with a lower IQ. IQ is, you know, by your late teens, is about 85% genetic. There's a little bit of wiggle room, but not that much. So it is not people's fault that they're born with lower IQs, and we must have sympathy, and we must also, I believe, have a sense of obligation, if we happen to be born with very high IQs, to help the world. So one of the reasons why, because we don't talk about this kind of stuff, people end up with a lot of resentment and a lot of rage, and it is very primitive. It is very superstitious. It is downright crazy. If you look at poor people, poverty is generally associated with a lower IQ, and the achievement and maintenance of wealth is generally associated with a higher IQ. And again, it's not the poor people's fault if they're poor because of low IQ. It's not their fault. It's just the way they're born. If they happen to be born short, they ain't going to make it to the NBA. And it's not because they didn't try, not because they didn't practice, not because they didn't work hard at it. You have to have sympathy for people who are struggling with limitations. That is not fair. It's not right. It's not their fault. Have some sympathy. Now, if you have sympathy for the people who are, through no fault of their own, born with lower IQs as a whole, then it's also possible to have less hatred for people who have achieved wealth and status because of being born with high IQs. Because it's so primitive in a way, because what happens is, if there's some disease that's running through a town and you blame witches, well, I guess you can vent the rage that you feel about the disease and your vulnerability to it. You can have the sick, sadistic joy of dragging some women and a few men out of their homes and boiling them alive or setting them on fire or otherwise eviscerating them or throwing them in prison for being witches. The only thing is you're not doing anything about the actual disease and you're making a bad situation worse. And in the same way, when you look at income inequality, wealth distribution, and so on, people get this all kind of wrong. They fundamentally don't understand it. They don't understand it. It's largely IQ. Now, a lot of it has to do with corruption and predation within a very overextended and oversized government, but nonetheless, in a free market, this will happen. You say, oh, there's a concentration of wealth among a small percentage of people. It's like, no, the wealth is kind of created by a small percentage of people in the free market. I mean, I'm not talking about government redistribution and the military industrial complex and so on, but wealth is created, right? So people say, well, Jeff Bezos earns in, I don't know, what, 20 minutes, what some guy earns in a year or whatever. It's like, but that's not just... I mean, he creates more value. Don't think of earning money. Think of creating value. That's the reality. And so if we have sympathy for the poor, then we can also let go of rage towards the rich and the cognitive elite, because it's just the way the dice roll. Now, if happiness is your concern, if it's any consolation, the smarter you are, there's not any particular correlation with being happier. And I think most of us would take happiness over just about anything else, given that happiness generally requires good health and enough to eat and so on. So don't get too mad at the cognitive elites for being happier than you are, because it doesn't seem to be much association there at all. But it is important to just look. I return to singing ability because it's a great way to understand this. People are born with a wide distribution of singing ability, both the physical instrument of the voice and your capacity for a perfect pitch and all of that kind of stuff, and your willingness to work at it, your desire to sing, and so on. And so it's true that the best singers tend to make the most money, right? But that's not unfair or unequal. They just happen to be born with great voices, and they happen to have a desire to train for it. And the training is associated with a great voice, because if you don't have a great voice, why bother training it? You're never going to reach that kind of elite status. So it's not the fault of people who are born without good singing voices. And it's not some innate wonderful thing or bad thing that people are sometimes born with great singing voices. It's just nature and her endless tinkering. And we need to just start letting go of these ridiculous notions that all inequalities in income are the result of exploitation and racism and sexism and so on. At the highest levels of cognitive ability, men outstrip women in terms of the ratio by like 8 to 1, 10 to 1, 12 to 1. And at the very highest, there are virtually no women at all, you know, for reasons that in a sense don't really matter. These are the facts that we have to work with. So it's not just sexism. Now, here's something that's very, very interesting. So the history of the Cold War, just astounding. So they started running out of people during the draft. And here, of course, you have to put in President Trump's temporary bone spurs and blah, 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 right? And so what happened was they started drafting people for Vietnam, but a lot of people died over in Vietnam. A lot of people went into university because that's a way that you could defer the draft. And there were draft dodgers, of course. A lot of them moved to Canada. Some people even preferred to go to jail rather than be drafted. So they did not have enough troops to fight the battle. So they did try cracking down on draft dodgers. But then Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, this, of course, is in the 60s, what he decided to do was to draft men whose low IQ scores had hitherto disqualified them from military service. Right. And this has happened more recently as America's endless wars in the Middle East have ground on and on. Now, the longest, I think Afghanistan is the longest war that has ever been engaged in at 17 years plus. They have started saying, okay, well, if you have a criminal record, you can come in. And okay, right. So they lowered the intelligence requirement. Now, this stratagem, codenamed Project 100,000, and there's a book called McNamara's Folly, which you can find on Amazon. And they were cruelly nicknamed, these draftees, low IQ draftees, were nicknamed McNamara's morons. And that is, now this is an, I don't know if this is a typo or not. It says these draftees, cruelly nicknamed McNamara's morons, were generally capable of completing simple tasks, but even a simple task imperfectly executed can be disastrous in warfare. I don't know if it means incapable or capable, but I assume capable, right? They would have checked this. So there's an example of this guy named Jerry, is not his real name. And actually, they say it's Project 100,000. It actually was closer to 350,000 low IQ people who were drafted into the army in Vietnam. So this guy, Jerry, was a guard, and he was supposed to call halt, who goes there, followed by advance, and be recognized, which is not that hard because an American soldier does look a little bit different from the average Viet Cong guerrilla. So some well-liked American officer returned to camp. Jerry got this all wrong. He saw the officer approaching. He yelled, halt, and then opened fire, killing the man where he stood. So this guy, Jerry, subsequently disappeared, either remorseful, AWOL, or he was murdered by outraged members of his battalion. This one is astonishing, too, because you think, well, you know, you think of people of a low IQ maybe as kind of inert and so on. It's like, no, they just don't particularly read these kinds of cues and consequences. One of the, quote, morons played a joke on his squad mates by throwing a disarmed hand grenade at them. Despite being beaten up for it, he found this prank so amusing that he repeated it every day until the inevitable happened. He forgot to disarm the grenade, causing the deaths of two soldiers and the grievous wounding of several more. Now, what happened to a lot of these 350,000 low IQ draftees? So the writer says, to survive in combat, you had to be smart. You had to know how to use your rifle effectively and keep it clean and operable, how to navigate through jungles and rice paddies without alerting the enemy, and how to communicate and cooperate with other members of your team. Fulfilling all or any one of these minimum requirements, survival in a battlefield is contingent upon a certain level of verbal and visuospatial intelligence, which many of McNamara's draftees did not possess. This ultimately led to their fatality rate in Vietnam exceeding those of other GIs by a factor of three, right? So three times more of the low IQ people died relative to the average. And that is just astonishing. Now, it's not just about the battlefield. So this is a 2010 study by four psychologists using data from the Danish conscription database, which is over 728,000 men. Low IQ is a risk factor for almost all causes of death. A drop in IQ by a single standard deviation, roughly 15 points worth of IQ, so like 85 to 100 is a standard deviation. A drop in IQ by a single standard deviation was associated with a 28% increase in mortality risk. Big, big deal. The association between low IQ and mortality was particularly great for homicide and respiratory disease such as lung cancer, right? So you get involved in crime, you smoke, like all stuff which gives you an immediate hit at a long-term cost. The high homicide rate could reflect a predisposition for those of low IQ to find themselves in dangerous situations, perhaps due to a lack of economic opportunity or an increased likelihood of being victimized by predatory individuals. Again, lack of economic opportunity, you would have to look at, again, the America in the 1930s during the Great Depression. Was there a massive increase in crime despite there being a huge drop in economic opportunity? No. So, yeah. So, yeah, it's not just smoking, inhaling more polluted industrial areas where it's easier to find low-skilled work. I'm thinking of Freddie Gray and the lead paint that was in some of these ghetto houses. Just horrible. Being born with low IQ is sufficient to set one up for an unlucky and unhappy life. Very interesting. So those with low IQs are much more likely to experience misfortune in seemingly every endeavor, right? So having intelligence, the writer says, having intelligence is what allows us to operate in the world, both on our own and within the societies we inhabit. Now, this is particularly true in the modern West because we're automating a lot of lower skilled jobs. I mean, if you've ever seen the show Downton Abbey, I did a whole show on Downton Abbey, but you can see that there are people there who are, you know, washing dishes. There are people there who are going out and cutting wood and keeping the fires going and so on. Low IQ stuff. And again, I mean, I will say it's not an insult. It's just the way things are. Now, a lot of this stuff has been automated. And if you have a house, go down to your basement, look at all the equipment down there and think of how many people it would take to keep you warm in the winter and keep you cool in the summer. And like, it's all automated. And computers are automating things and robots are automating things. And like, you name it, it's being automated. And this means that the requirement for lower IQ people is going down and down and down. And that is a huge problem, and not to mention the fact that the West is currently importing millions and millions of people from lower IQ populations at a time when automation is increasing. It's a recipe for the kind of disaster that has never been seen before in human history. Never been seen before in human history. Now, this is a good point. Those lucky enough to have high IQ, says the writer, have an easier time at dispatching the various challenges they face and thus naturally rise within hierarchies of competence. Of course, right? Of course. And this is why some people say that meritocracies are racist, right? And this is some of these areas of success. Friendship, groups, romantic relationships, professional employment are so fundamental to the individual pursuit of happiness that to be unable to progress in them is profoundly damaging to one's sense of well-being and intrinsic self-worth. And that is very important. Once we start to understand this basic biological reality, that IQ is unevenly distributed within and between populations, we can start to deal with the facts and reduce these artificial answers of sexism and racism and the hatred that engenders and the rage and the frustration. Like, we're really cruel to people using the current false narratives, and we need to start dealing with science. Yeah, we need to start dealing with science. You know, a lot of people who are atheists can't believe it took so long for people who are religious to give up their superstitions, so to speak. Not that I agree with that particular way of phrasing it anymore, but the reality is that the radical egalitarianism that's on the left, which says all inequalities are the result of exploitation, is a far more damaging ideology than fundamentalist religiosity. And it's very hard for people to let go of that way of explaining the world. And it's a tougher problem to solve than people think. So, yeah, it's really, really frustrating. So, yeah, there's times where you try to do something and you can't really do it that well. And here's the writer says, very few of us know what it is like to have that feeling of failure almost all the time. And to have a large proportion of one's attempt at self-betterment or advancement frustrated by forces that seem to be beyond our control. And this is the cruelty we have of not talking about IQ, of not talking about IQ and its distribution, because it is incredibly frustrating. If we say everyone's equal and somebody keeps failing at something, they're going to get really angry. They're going to get really enraged, and they're going to be perceived that there's this weird barrier between them and success that is the result not of unlucky roles genetically, but as the result of evil and exploitation and privilege on the part of others. And the consequences of that are beyond, like, people literally get killed. Entire societies can die based upon this delusion. So, yeah, this guy who ended up shooting up people in Australia, it was tough. You know, he couldn't really make friends. He was lonely. He was depressed and got increasingly enraged and frustrated. And, of course, was told that he's kind of like everyone else, and therefore his lack of success must be other people's fault, as opposed to, sorry, man, you can't sing. You don't get a place in the choir. Now, what happens to people as a whole is a big question. We'll talk about that another time. I don't have all the answers other than freedom is the answer, but we're not even at the place where really intelligently talking about these issues. So if we look at college completion, of course, it's a huge issue. But the one thing I think that is a challenge here with this, as a whole is that he says, well, there aren't that many job opportunities available for people with lower IQs, and therefore they get so angry and frustrated. But not only is that not differentiating things by race or ethnicity, but it also is not differentiating by gender because of the welfare state. We have another situation entirely. And that situation is this, that if you are a woman, then you can just have babies and the government will forcibly redistribute resources from other people, people who have jobs, people who are being productive, probably people of a higher IQ. So what happens is, if you're a man, sure, you may be drawn to a life of crime, you may be drawn to a life of danger, you may be drawn to a wide variety of things, or you may get a good job and not earn that much, but have a solid social circle and a decent life. But if you're a woman, you can just choose to have babies. And if you have babies, you will make a good deal of money. And of course, if you're a man, you can choose to impregnate women. What do they call the welfare state houses, the government houses, Section 8 houses, girlfriend farms, right? You just go and impregnate a woman, and then you can live off her welfare, cycling from place to place. So this is a huge challenge and a huge problem. We're not even close to beginning a rational conversation about this. And we're making decisions as a society, particularly to do with accepting migrants and immigration as a whole, without any cognizance of these issues. So I'm really, really glad that people are starting to write about this kind of stuff. And hopefully we can get a conversation moving forward using these basic scientific facts. But it's a big challenge. People are really, really upset by this. And as an old Oscar Wilde line says, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. And the first rule of IQ is you must talk about IQ. And the second rule of IQ is, if you think it's hard to talk about IQ, see what happens to your society when you don't.
Glenn Beck. It's Pat and Stu and Jeffy for Glenn.
727 Beck. Yes. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been a while. And with all these phone numbers to remember, I can't. I'm just incapable of it now. I'm too old, I think. You mentioned on the little pre-show thing that the civil asset forfeiture situation, which has gotten so out of control in this country. We've talked about people who have been pulled over in Texas and they were on their way to buy a car and they had, 30 some thousand dollars with them, and the law enforcement saw it, found it, took it, and they just lost it. The guy with the pizza parlor who took his money to the bank every day, the cash that he made and brought and took it from the till to the bank. And because he was told, hey, if you deposit $10,000 in cash, they're going to flag that and they're going to, look into you because it might be a drug. It might be some sort of drug deal when you're depositing that kind of money. So he always brought in under $10,000. That got flagged, and they took it from him.
The guy at the airport that had the receipt for the money from the bank. So because they said, if you're going to travel, make sure you have the receipts and proof that it's yours. Right. Nope, we're taking that.
Yeah, in one case, guy got pulled over, had $91,000. I forget what he was going to do with it. He was buying something, too. He was on his way to make some sort of purchase. I'm trying to think, because I think I have the story here.
But
$91,000, and they took it from him, and he didn't get
really,
it back.
I mean, never who charged. Cares what he wanted to do with his money?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, supposed to be America.
If he winds up doing something with his money that's illegal, that's the time you charge him with it.
Thank you.
You don't just charge him for it, assuming he's doing something illegal.
Well, if you've got evidence, let's see it. Charge him with a crime. Yeah. But they're not doing that, and
it's quite clearly the assumption of guilt rather than the assumption of innocence, which is what our entire system is built up on.
Exactly. In 2016, there was a guy in Utah who got pulled over by the Utah Highway Patrol because he was following a vehicle too closely.
Man, do I hate
they search his car, and he's got a bag in it that has $500,000 in the bag They took it from him. This was in 2016. He still hasn't been charged with crime. They don't have any evidence that it was a drug deal. But they took $500,000 from him. And he's been fighting ever since to try to get it back. He went all the way to the Utah Supreme Court, who just ruled that they have to give it back to him. They still haven't. They still haven't because the feds and the state of Utah are fighting over how to divide the money. The federal government says it's ours. It's all ours. And the state is trying to take some of it. So, I mean, none of it is yours. Give it back to the guy or charge him with a crime. Let's see the evidence.
And I'd be interested what caused them to actually search the car for driving too close on the ticket.
Did you? It didn't have that in the... in the story.
You think if you're bringing around $500,000 in your car.
Oh, it says, okay, a drug dog alerted authorities to the presence of narcotics, but none were found. So there weren't any.
No, the money smelled like drugs. Perhaps. That's what happens. The dog smelled the money.
Okay.
And the drug dog thing, it can potentially have some value, but first of all, a dog is not evidence, right?
Yeah.
Like, well, it might give you in today's world, it is.
I know, but what I'm saying is, if you have, it may give you the opportunity to search for evidence. And you know, there's a lot of stories out there about how unreliable, you know, drug dogs are. And they're, you know, I mean,
they make mistakes. They're not perfect.
Like, they're not, you know, they're, it's not science, right? It's just like, you know, they might give you an indication is about all it's worth.
And you're suspicious of somebody who's carrying around $500,000 because who carries around $500,000?
Right.
Well, I don't know, but he's an American. So if he has $500,000 and you don't have any evidence that he got it illegally,
well, again, the drug dog alerted them that there was
possible
drugs.
But then there wasn't.
But then there was no drugs.
Right. So leave him alone, give him back his money, send him on his way. How can it still be America when you can just have your property seized like that?
And there's plenty of departments. That was the big fight with when the sheriffs went to D.C. and talk to Trump, right? They were all for that, and because those departments are, they're using the "hey, we're stopping drugs" as a good benefit to enhance income for those departments.
And I'm sure it is, but you better be charging people with a crime if you're going to take their property. They better have gotten it illegally, whatever it is. In too many cases, you've just taken law-abiding American citizens, hard-earned, in some cases, life savings from them. That's unbelievable to me.
And there are a lot of law enforcement officials who support this really strongly. And they say, look, it makes it a lot easier to get convictions. Well, of course it does. When you take everybody's stuff and then you figure it out later, you know, yeah, it's going to be easier to get convictions. And sometimes those convictions will be accurate. However, there is a presumption of innocence in our society. It's supposed to be that way. And the idea that you can just flip that upside down and say, well, we're going to take your stuff until we figure it out is completely wrong.
Yeah.
Completely wrong.
Yeah.
And then beyond that.
It's unconstitutional.
Yeah. To take pieces of it because you think you've gone through some efforts to check out the story. Like, no, you should be paying them. I mean, like, it's closer to rational for the state to pay someone in where they have taken them into custody incorrectly or have handled them in some wrong way than it is the other way around. I mean, the fact that you're taking my money and then you're going to take a piece of it for your trouble, like, you didn't do me a service. I just, you know, it's tough to say. I know Jeff Sessions is a big proponent of this. He's huge on this, and he pushes.
So was the president, actually.
Yeah, and the president, and this is one of the very few things anymore they actually agree on, apparently. But it's just not right. And it's, you know, while at times it feels like it would be the right thing to do, and you might say to yourself, well, I would never bring around $500,000 in cash. Are we progressives? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are we hardcore leftists?
Nobody,
where we say we get to
carry
tell
that much around.
Are we the people that get to say to others how much of their own money they get to bring in their own car?
Yeah.
Is that really the position we want to take?
You have to ask yourself, is it illegal in the United States of America to carry cash with you?
I mean, if it is.
A large sum.
Show me the law.
Yeah.
Because it's not.
Right.
It's not illegal to bring your money somewhere.
If I want to carry $500 million with me in cash, if I have that kind of money, I should be able to.
Mm-hmm.
And if I get pulled over, nobody should be able to take it from me. It's un-American and it's unconstitutional. And it's amazing how many politicians are in favor of it.
Yeah, you know, And I'm surprised.
It's not supposed to be easy to get convictions. It's supposed to be hard. Yeah. There's a burden of proof.
Right, exactly. It should be hard.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to take, think about what's happening here. You're taking constitutional rights away from someone, mm-hmm. right? You're taking away the right to pursue happiness, right?
Yeah.
Because you're in prison. You're taking away your Second Amendment rights. You'll probably never get them back if you're a felon.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of things you're just ripping away. The right of free association you're taking away. You're taking away tons of things that are constitutionally guaranteed. And, of course, the Constitution does not guarantee them when you commit crimes. When you commit crimes, you lose those rights. You lose voting mm-hmm. rights.
Right.
Okay? So these are really important issues that should have a very high standard of proof. They should have a burden mm-hmm. that is difficult for the state to accomplish. We should be letting go some people who are guilty. We should be, every once in a while, erring on that side instead of the other. And, of course, we all want someone who's guilty to go to prison and deal with those consequences. One of the most important issues to me is law enforcement. And, the police, generally speaking, do an incredible job. I mean, they're a hell of a lot better for this society than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Jeffy, obviously. That didn't need to be said.
No, of course.
I don't think. But you can't, just because we want to take criminals off the streets does not mean we can reverse the Constitution to make it easier. We can't do that. That's not something that the reason the Constitution is there is to protect against these things. And I'm surprised there's not more of an uprising on this, because it's one of those issues you'd think both the left and the right could agree. Private property being taken by the government, right in the conservative wheelhouse.
Yeah.
What do you mean you're taking my government my money for nothing? And then the left should agree with us, too. You know, they're always complaining about how the police do things that are wrong and taking advantage of people who they shouldn't take advantage of. I mean, there's stories from Chicago where people, and there's this story about a guy who was in Chicago, and he was a car repair technician.
Oh, right.
And so he took his car and gave a ride to someone who brought his car to his shop. He'd give rides to people to work or wherever they needed to go. And while he was on the way, giving a ride to someone else, the car got pulled over for what they said was a broken taillight, and he denies. But when they decided to take the people out of the car and search them, when they searched them, the passenger, the customer, was found with heroin. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, is he supposed to, frisk every customer that comes into his office? The customer is caught with it. They take his car, impound it, and he's been fighting for years to get it back.
Oh, my gosh.
Not to mention, all of his tools, thousands of dollars of tools, were in the trunk of the car. And he couldn't get those back either. So he did nothing wrong, was never charged with anything wrong, was never suspected of doing anything wrong. And they took his car away for multiple years. I think it's still ongoing, at least last I checked.
That's
it's cost
incredible.
Him thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Wow.
More than the car was worth, he's paid to try to get the car back. Because all the tools are in the back of his car. And he can't do his work without them. This is insanity.
And I guarantee you they're charging him to keep the car.
Yeah, they are.
Absolutely. They all
pay.
Do that.
The impound fees.
Yes,
he can't work.
That's perfect.
So he can't get the money to pay the impound fees. And then as he doesn't pay the impound fees, they get fines on top of the fees.
Yes. What's agonizing?
And he has to keep going back to court and hiring lawyers. I mean, it's insanity, and there's no reason for it. I can't understand why people just aren't up in arms over this issue.
I know. We should be protesting in the streets on this, because it's one of the most un-American things I think I've ever seen in my lifetime. This is as bad as it gets in a free society, because you're not free if we're able to do this. There's no proof. There's no evidence. There's no due process.
Well, it's possible.
Wow.
It's possible you did something wrong.
It is possible.
It is possible.
Right. It is possible. So, lock him up.
Safety first.
Spend his money.
Better safe than sorry. Throw him in prison. No, that's not how this works.
It isn't.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.